I don't have 100 people signed up, just a few.
Wow.
City Council will come to order. Sue, please call the roll.
Adams.
Here.
Leonard.
Here.
Saltzman. Sten. Potter.
Here. I'd like to remind folks that prior to offering public testimony in City Council, a lobbyist must declare which lobbying entity he or she is authorized to represent. Please read the 2 p.m. time certain.
Item 521, accept a report on the Work Systems, Inc. System Alignment Committee and give an update on the future budgetary impacts of workforce development for the city, Multnomah, and Washington counties.
Mr. Adams.
Thank you, Mayor. Members of the City Council, the issue we're going to hear about today is not just an issue of important public policy, but for me it also has a personal aspect. As a family who went through tough times as Oregon went through recessions, growing up in Newport, my family sought assistance, training assistance, educational funding assistance, just plain old public housing and food stamps. And through that personal experience at the time, I got to know firsthand how difficult it can be for folks that are trying to improve themselves and get through tough times to access the public services that are available to them or potentially available to them, and how disaggregated they can be, how fragmented they can be. And so I asked the mayor to appoint me to Work Systems, WSI, in an effort to try to improve services to the unemployed and underemployed in Portland, Multnomah County, and Washington County, which is the service territory of WSI. WSI, or also known as Work Systems Incorporated, is probably one of the least known but important agencies serving the unemployed and underemployed. 6 months ago, we reported to council that WSI had completed a three-year strategic plan that sets forth advocacy and engagement around five goals that will aid in the preparation of training of a skilled local workforce. Since that time, we have formed subcommittees to focus on accomplishing these five goals. And I've taken on chair of the Systems Alignment Committee, and my job is to work with the stakeholders and providers and clients, which include both businesses and those individuals seeking to move up the economic ladder, to align the resources and services to better serve them and therefore improve the economic vitality of the community. What you're going to see and hear out of our initial investigation of what's out there is over $150 million in federal, state, and local resources going to the effort of improving opportunities for the unemployed or chronically underemployed. And what you are going to see is the opportunity to spend that money better to the benefit of more people and our economic vitality as a whole. So I'm very excited about sharing this report with you. It's going to seem very wonkish and very inside baseball with more acronyms than anyone should have to endure, but it is also very important. And my work in this area is done in partnership with James Polson, who's chair of the board of WSI, and Andrew McGaugh, who's the executive director. And we've done amazing things to turn this organization around, me in the last 2 years, you in the last 4 years. And it's I wanted, at the outset of your presentation, to thank you for all of those efforts and your commitment to improving the performance of not just WSI, but all of our sort of partner providers in this area. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. I'd like to start by saying thank you, Commissioner Adams, for your participation in helping us to kind of drive this forward. It's with your help and insight and input that's really helped us kind of execute on a lot of things that you'll hear from today. Again, I'm James Paulson, and I wear two hats as I come before the City Council today. One hat is the chairman of WSI, and the other hat is the manager of recruitment for Kaiser Permanente. I'm sorry that I won't be able to stay for the entire presentation because I am double booked. But I think it's kind of interesting, the other engagement that I have to make. It's actually to be a keynote speaker to a program that's our Pathways to Healthcare Careers. And what this program is a joint venture between WSI and the healthcare industry. And what we're really doing is we're looking at youth and getting youth engaged in healthcare careers and helping them understand what careers are out there. Many of the youth that are served in this program are youth that are coming out of Outside In and other alternative programs. And so really trying to engage with these folks in a way in which they can then benefit much more for a long term for themselves and for our community. So I'm really excited about the opportunity to speak to these kids because Kaiser, as a participant in this program, we are very much, we like the program a lot. Now, Andrew's going to talk to you a lot about a lot of the different specifics on programs and so forth, but really what I wanted to do is come here and really talk to you from an industry business standpoint. And yes, I do work in healthcare and so forth, but we at WSI, we really look at the entire spectrum. And even within healthcare, you know, there's a care delivery side, and then there's the rest of the city, as we like to talk about, that are employees of ours. And one thing, when you talk about workforce and you talk about the city, you need to talk about all of workforce. And I think that one of the things that we're really working on is really trying to address all workforce, whether that's the workforce of tomorrow, you know, the high-tech jobs, the glamorous workforce. But I think that we can't lose sight of the nitty-gritty workforce that we need to engage with, the dislocated workers, the people who, for whatever reason, kind of fell off the quote-unquote standard route of employment. And that's a lot of people that we serve. And when you look forward and you look at, you know, oh, well, there's going to be all the baby boomers leaving and we're going to need nurses and this, that, and the other. Well, I want to really point out that we're going to need a lot more than nurses going forward. We're going to need welders. We're going to need people who in customer service jobs. We're going to need all jobs top to bottom. And we really need to get involved in training that next wave of workforce so that they will be competitive, both globally competitive as well as competitive just here within our community. And I think that a lot of the work that we're doing here at WSI is really to build that foundation. Thank you for the opportunity to speak.
Thanks, James. And Mr. Mayor, thanks for inviting me today. And Commissioner Adams, I really appreciate the opportunity. This is going to be slightly wonkish. I'll try and be as less wonkish as possible, but I think
as entertaining as possible.
I'm in good company. So without further ado, I'll just go through this presentation, and certainly if you have questions, please feel free to stop me at any time. As Commissioner Adams mentioned, we just recently passed a strategic plan. We came before the council about 6 months ago and shared the goals in that plan. And really my discussion today is about some of the progress we've made towards the achievement of some of those goals. And as Commissioner Adams also mentioned, he has agreed and has done a tremendous job in leading one of the real important foundational committees related to the achievement of the goals in those plans, and that's this System Alignment Committee. And if you'll notice, as Commissioner Adams mentioned, that committee consists of about 38 community members, many on the board. So it's an array of public and private representation on this committee to try and wrestle with the issue of what's out there for workforce development, and are we lined up in a way that really makes highest and best use of the resources and also results in the kind of services that business and job seekers and workers really need. And I guess the first thing I would point out is one of the good things about the plan is by design, the committees were designed to allow non-board members to participate on the committee by design. And I think this is a really good example with 38 community members. BHCD is part of this, Multnomah County, Washington County, whole array of service-providing organizations as well as business associations.
And unions.
Pardon me?
Excuse me, in union.
Oh, yes, labor representation. It's a great mix of people. It's the kind of table that we need to really have a substantive discussion about how are these skill development efforts really lining up with the short and long-term needs in the economy. So it's a really good mix. But one of the first things that the committee said we need to do is we need to understand the environment. What's the environment look like? So a couple months ago, we issued an RFP, competitive RFP. Echo Northwest was selected to do the work. And I've provided you a full copy of their presentation, which they delivered on April 13th. But I'm just going to point out a few highlights of that. So they were engaged to sort of do an inventory of funding sources and providers, measure those investments, and also categorize the services in some broad categories. And I also provided those for your edification later on. But some of the key findings, they found about 80 service providers in this community, meaning the city of Portland, Washington, Multnomah counties, were engaged in some form of workforce development. They examined 2,000 expenditure line items and over $150 million in annual resources invested in these activities. Of those resources, about 71% are federal, 71 million, 48% federal, about 34 million in state resources, 37 in local resources, and 6.1 million in other resources, which are really like foundational dollars and other grants to small organizations. The primary service providers in the community that are delivering services related to those resources are break down into four prime categories: community colleges, state and local governments, not-for-profit organizations, and school districts. And the school district's a bit of an anomaly. That's really focused on Carl Perkins money, which is vocational technical dollars that go directly to K through 12. But nonetheless, they fit in that category of workforce development. Well, even though we did this work, there is a significant mystery remains that I think is really going to frame the work of the committee moving forward over the next year or so. I mean, this is a pretty big question. It's really how many people are served by this system, who does the service, and at what cost? Because part of the thing that we found is we have very little or no capacity to talk about unduplicated counts of people. So if you're served by one program, we have lots of data that'll tell you, you know, program A served 15 people at a cost of $30,000. But it doesn't tell you if those people accessed other resources in order to achieve that outcome. And that's really the picture we need to paint in order to establish kind of the benchmarks I think we need to move forward. Our next steps, obviously, this is a very new report to us, and as staff to the committee, we are meeting with Echo Northwest next week, as a matter of fact, to go through all of those 2,000 line items one by one, reaffirm how they categorize those costs, and just sort of generally clean up the data. But the committee also recommended three motions to the board, which they overwhelmingly approved, and that is we need to look at what are the outcomes that we're all trying to achieve, and can we define some common performance measures for these broad array of programs and services engaged in workforce development. And I think Commissioner Adams is really doing a great job of leading that conversation forward, because it's a tough one to get to, but I think people really feel that there is some big opportunity there. Second one is really looking at the funding organizations and trying to come up with some language that we can agree to, and I say we because we are really a funding organization ourselves, but language that we might be able to insert into contractual agreements or other service provision agreements that helps us better define the outcomes that we're all commonly charged to produce. And then finally, this notion of trying to look at common data systems, and people get edgy about that, but you know, technology is much different today than it used to be. And common may be a misnomer. It's really about sharing data in a much more sophisticated way than we currently do it. So I'd like to kind of shift from that to a good story and another major accomplishment. And this is about a telephone number. But it really starts with a story that I hope you'll indulge me. A few months ago, I was asked to, the City Club was thinking about doing a forum on workforce development and education. And, you know, they have those researchers, they get the research committee together and they sit around the table and they call in local people who are engaged in that and they ask them questions. And so they asked me to come and I was talking to the group and there was a guy there and he's just kind of nodding his head and he's kind of putting his hands up there. He's clearly frustrated. And finally he just says, look, this workforce stuff, it doesn't work. And I'm going to tell you why. And he says, I had a company in here yesterday and that company they needed marine welders. And that company contacted the public system and they couldn't get them anything. And so this guy, you know, he had a big demand. So he went to South America and he imported these welders. And by the way, he had to pay those welders $6 more an hour than he would pay a domestic welder. So, you know, this notion that they're actually saving money just went out the window. So I kind of hemmed and hawed and put my tail between my legs and went back to my office. And I was thinking about that, his question. So I got to my office and I called my friend at the Oregon Employment Department, Christian Kaler, who's a great labor market economist. And I said, Christian, can you look on your data system and tell me how many people you have with 6 or more months of welding experience who are currently actively seeking employment? Christian did his thing, and he told me he had 1,080 people. So what that says to me is there's some fundamental disconnect between those that are seeking workers and those who are managing the data and managing the pool of people who might be qualified to fill that job. So what this telephone number does for us is I think it answers 3 really important requests of the business community. And frankly, I don't think these are business community requests or unique to the business community. I think they transcend that to workers and job seekers as well. And it's like, what do you really want out of the public system? You want a qualified worker. You want a single point of contact, and you want accountability. And I think that this telephone number helps us do that. So today, if you're looking for an employee, or if you're an organization and you're looking for an employee in the Portland metropolitan area, because this number does include Clackamas County, and you call this number, a live body picks up the phone and they say, how can I help you? And someone says, I'm looking for welders. They log that name. And so now we have a place to go to see whether or not the system actually delivered on that request. And we know who's supposed to do it. But what this number also does is helps to consolidate the provision of business services. Because if you look at this nasty-looking diagram, it's actually a pretty conservative picture of how business services were actually delivered in the region up until March 1st of this year. Because we actually did a look a while back, and I would probably argue that there's probably about 300 people in this community whose job it is to job develop. So this could be a much messier picture. But what we've evolved to today is more of this kind of picture. So not only did we create a single telephone number, what we did was we reorganized a state agency into industry teams. So now there are a team of, say, 5 people assigned at the Oregon Employment Department whose job it is to serve the manufacturing industry, whose job it is to serve the healthcare industry. And so these folks are organized to be that single point of contact and be that accountability structure that we need to know whether or not these services are actually working. And so, I mean, from a systems perspective, this is where it gets wonkish, Commissioner, but I can't help it. But there's a lot of value in trying to move sort of the aircraft carrier. And I think that's really what we do at Work Systems, and we're trying to do it behind the scenes, because really what this does for us is we used to invest in a lot of job developers and we invested in a lot of business services, but we don't have to do that anymore. And we can target our resources to training people, which is where we think we get the biggest return for our investment. So the next phase, actually, I want to just give you another specific example. So these industries teams, so they're put together, and I took them to, I'm on the management committee of an organization called Manufacturing 21, which is a group of metals industry and related manufacturers in the region, and they're advocating a lot for workforce programs. So I took them to one of their meetings, introduced them to the team, and out of that, three of their members, Gunderson, Vigor Marine, and Eklund Industries, said, hey, we still need welders. Can you help us? So these guys did a customized recruitment using their data system. They pulled people from that data system, and they did a customized recruitment, and it resulted in 33 interviews for Gunderson, 33 interviews for Vigor, and 20 interviews by Eklund. They did a post-service customer satisfaction survey, and they scored their highest ratings on these things for quality of candidates and communications and follow-up. Now, the real sort of other thing that we're waiting for is on July 1st, what they'll do at the Oregon Employment Department is they will pull from their unemployment insurance data system. So they will be able to do an exact match of all of the people who were actually hired out of this process. No one can do that except for the Oregon Employment Department. So in terms of accountability and trying to figure out, well, did this thing really work, this is the best way to do that, is by using the unemployment insurance data system. So the next phase in this system development work is about training, and it is about increasing access to training for disadvantaged people, for people who are working and they're not making enough money to support themselves or their family, and how do we increase that? So what we've done is, because we saved some money at Work Systems, we've created what we call a training fund. And that fund is going to be targeted to high-growth, high-demand occupations in our community. And really what it's going to do for me, I think, is I can be very explicit with industry now about what we're going to do with our investments. So, for example, let's use we'll stay on the welder track. Since I have connections with Manufacturing 21 and other industry organizations around the city, I will convene those folks, because we've done a lot of research on what are the high-growth occupations, and so we want to validate that data and say, okay, you need this kind of welder and you need this. And okay, we have $300,000, for example, or say, that we're willing to invest to fill those openings. What can you bring to the table? Because creating these kinds of public-private partnerships is the only way we're going to be able to sustain these kinds of changes, I think, in our community over the long haul. And frankly, I think industry is ready and willing to step up. And it doesn't necessarily have to be a resource contribution. So, for example, over the years, we've made significant investments in things called career pathways, which are really chunking down college curriculum that allow people to get short-term certificates that engage them in a career path in a high-growth industry. Well, if we cut a deal with an employer, for example, and said, look, we'll pay for rungs 1 and 2 on the ladder, and when you're ready to make an investment in that individual, will you pay for rungs 3 and 4? So really trying to get those investments that employers already make and targeting them into certifications for people really get us both the end result that we want, which is more highly qualified workers that if a given company goes down, we still know that they're in a position that they can go out and get a job somewhere else. So we think it's a deal that industry's ready to cut, and they're ready to come to the table to help us out. So that's kind of some of the base accomplishments that we've seen over the year. We do have a few challenges. We get our money primarily from federal sources, and this year we received a 27% cut, or just over $2.7 million to the region in resources that come from the federal government to provide these services. In real numbers, that means about 700 fewer adults will receive training in the community, about 150 fewer youth, 950 fewer individuals placed into jobs, and about 460 fewer current workers will receive upgrades to help them be more competitive in the workplace. I'm not quite sure what we do about that, although I am a firm believer that it is about partnership somehow down the line. And I do think that we have to reconsider our over-reliance on federal resources to get some of this work done. And I guess just in closing, I still think that there's a lot of opportunity for us. I think that this system alignment work that Commissioner Adams is pushing forward is really, really a fundamental key to figuring out how we use the resources that we have in the most effective way. And then also looking to enhance these public-private partnerships and building these broader regional relationships, working with our colleagues across the river, working with some folks down in Clackamas County. It really is about the labor shed more and more as opposed to sort of jurisdictional boundaries. And then finally, I think this continued coordination with economic development, because we do know that workforce is increasingly a driver of economic development as opposed to an afterthought. So the better we can do in terms of promoting our regional workforce, I think the more competitive we're going to be in terms of business expansion and relocation. So thank you very much. I really do appreciate the time.
Well, I want to add that if we fail, what we risk is, you know, because our efforts are targeted at chronically unemployed or underemployed, if we fail, what it means is that the companies that are looking for these workers for some of these higher wage jobs, they'll continue to recruit from outside the area. And we risk further solidifying this sort of economic underclass of the folks that are already here. So the risk of failure is pretty profound.
I would agree.
We've been joined by one of the new members of the Board of Higher Education for the state of Oregon and a former city commissioner. I was wondering, I didn't work this out ahead of time, but I was wondering if you wouldn't mind saying a few words from your perspective, how you feel about efforts underway. And welcome.
Thanks. It's nice to be here again. It's nice to see all of you, Mayor, members of the City Council, Commissioner Leonard, Commissioner Adams, Commissioner Sten. It's actually been a very heartwarming for me and reinvigorating to be involved on the education and training side since leaving you. You do very important work, and part of me missed it quite a bit. The issue of education and training for all of our citizens is something that you all care about, and it's something I've been able to focus on since leaving you in a variety of capacities. One of the things that's becoming clear to me is, you know, it's been tremendous, all the advocacy that you've done for K-12, and that's the fundamental building block here. It kind of pains me when I see at the legislature through, you know, community college and higher ed getting pitted against K-12 instead of kind of moving forward together. Because of your advocacy there and other things, I'm confident that we're going to get closer to the governor's budget, if not exceed it, for community colleges and higher ed, and then we can again, without taking it from K-12, and then we can move forward together. But as I'm listening to this terrific presentation by Andrew, one of the things I've been coming increasingly aware of is Commissioner Adams' remarks here at the end. But what do we do about all those people that have already graduated that are stuck in these dead-end jobs that can't afford health care? I mean, statistics and other things. Statistics are as high as 70 or 80% of the uninsured for health care are working people. So what do we do about them? The governor proposed $10 million, which the Oregonian recently called measly, for training for the underemployed that we've got to figure out strategies to reach. The truth of the matter is there's no constituency. There's no advocates for those people. There isn't. So I'm much less confident that training fund is going to get any money. So as I'm listening, part of the reason that there haven't been advocates is it is harder for working people to advocate for themselves. Yes, that's true. But another part is it's been harder to find accountability in the work to explain it the way Andrew just did and to communicate it, because you all want to do something on workforce because you understand low-income housing is important, but you also understand giving people the ability to earn higher wages is as important, not more important, but as important. But because there's no systems in place, you don't know how to access it. You don't know how to be champions for workforce. Well, Andrews has just given you away, because I've been really impressed. He didn't tell you his background is as an economist. But he's also trying to advocate for the employment division to do their part, which is do the job placement so he can free up resources from other systems for the training and invest in the people. And so with Commissioner Adams' leadership on making systems accountable, there is now that question is starting to be answered, so then the rest of us can kind of step up and do our part. What could be misinterpreted from the presentation you just saw was when I saw the $150 million, I thought, well, there's a lot of money already out there. Let's just redirect that. The problem that what didn't come through is all that money has so many strings attached on it. So food stamp money, if you're in a gang, you get money. If you have if you're high risk, you're in the money. The problem is the unions understand this, and there's labor management training in the apprenticeship programs, which is terrific. But if you're not in one of those programs, you're stuck in a dead-end job, and you don't have any of these strings attached that all that $150 million has, there's nothing for you. So, again, this wasn't rehearsed either with Andrew or with Sam, but I appreciate Commissioner Adams, but I appreciate the opportunity. So what we need, I think, from you are two things. One is we need more champions like Commissioner Adams to step up and rally around. We've got to figure out a way to get more training for working people who are underemployed. And we've got to figure it out about how we're going to do that. Secondly, you need to get yourselves in a position where you can leverage that $150 million and make it more effective. So part of it is the work of the committee. But if you put a little, and I know it's past your budget process, and this wasn't, but in the next cycle, if you could consider how to put a little bit of resources in this that's unrestricted, that puts you in a stronger position to leverage the $150 million. And some of that money can be directed at those statistics about who he's had to cut back. So you can simultaneously affect people that you want, working people, and put yourself in a position to go to others to leverage the $150 million. So that would be my suggestion. Thank you for giving me the opportunity.
Great comments. Good best wishes in your new position on the higher ed board.
There's going to be a strategy about higher ed in Portland and the connection with the – so Commissioner Adams, we're going to be – you and I are meeting about that. But I'd like at some future point to come back and talk with you about that as well.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Andrew.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
There was a sign-up sheet, and we don't have anyone signed up.
This is report. It's a report. I need a motion to accept.
So moved.
I didn't want to do my own report.
You almost had to.
I know.
Sue, please call the vote.
Adams.
Again, thank you to the great team at WSI. It's a pleasure to work with you. Thanks to Warren Jimenez on my staff, who works with me, Jane Ames, who works on higher education, and thanks to the mayor for giving me this assignment. Aye.
Leonard.
Excellent report. I appreciate all the work that's being done. I agree with the comments that these are really strategic investments that bring huge returns back to the city if they're done right. So, again, thanks very much. Aye.
Sten.
Yeah, I feel very optimistic and look forward to working with you on this. And actually, it's good to see Commissioner Francesconi. And I completely agree with all of what you said, and particularly the point that I think there's a lot more will than there is understanding of how to impact it. So I think that, if you can get this system, which I think has done good work, but is not accessible to even people who are pretty sophisticated and want to get their the things they work with tied into it, I think it could maybe exponentially jump. And I think that the cost of not doing so you outlined very eloquently. So yeah, thanks for bringing this, and thanks to Sam for his work on this. And I look forward to hopefully helping get this there. And I feel we're in good hands. So keep it up. Aye.
Potter.
Well, I really like the fact that it's strategic, it's outcome-based, it's focused, and that it can demonstrate the efficacy of these programs. So I'm very pleased with this, and I really wish WSI and the good folks there the best in the next year, and also appreciate Commissioner Adams' leadership there. Thank you. Aye. Got a couple minutes, so we'll go to the regular agenda. Read item 523.
523, replace code section obstructions as nuisances with new section sidewalk obstructions.
Second reading, vote only.
Adams?
Aye.
Leonard?
Aye.
Sten?
Congratulations, Mr. Mayor. Good job. Aye.
Potter?
Aye. My watch says it's about 2 minutes till. I think it's okay to read the 245.
Item 522, authorized contract with Dignity Village to manage transitional housing campground at Sunderland Yard.
Commissioners Adams and Stim.
There you go.
Okay, you want me to go?
All right.
No, you go.
No, you go.
This has been a definitely a partnership project with a number of bureaus and council offices in the city. chief of which is Commissioner Sten's office and his staff. The reason why I'm involved, in addition to a personal point of passion, is as transportation commissioner, Dignity Village was situated on land that is overseen by the Office of Transportation. I thought by way of introducing this, I'd just give a very quick background and highlights of the current agreement that's before the City Council for their consideration. And then I believe we have, do we have people signed up to testify?
Yes.
Okay. In 2002, Dignity Village was formed on ODOT land. A camp without structures, permanent structures, or semi-permanent structures.
It actually started down on the waterfront.
Started down on the waterfront and...
Yeah. And okay. Then it began to rain.
Then it began to
you
rain.
You want him to start out?
You sure you want to take this?
I think you're doing great. I'm enjoying it very much.
Okay. In trying to resolve the issues, campers were settled temporarily in Sunderland Yard. Sunderland Yard is a piece of property near the airport that the Portland Office of Transportation uses largely for the storage and processing of leaf materials. After a search for an alternative location turned up no alternatives, in 2004, Council designated part of Sunderland Yard for camping under state statute that allowed that designation in the event of housing shortages. 2005-2006, negotiations for the city with the city for a management agreement were initiated. The desire on both PDOT's part and on the part of the leadership at Dignity Village to try to improve their situation within the site, the overall Sunderland Yard site, and to make improvements to the campground, it seemed like a good thing to do. The new agreement, whereas before the there was not an agreement, but there was just a council, there was an agreement that this is built upon, and some of the changes and improvements to the earlier agreement is this is not a lease, but a management agreement. It runs until 2010. It sets basic rules and standards that have been discussed with all the parties involved. It sets the maximum occupancy at 60. It provides for quarterly reports from Dignity Village to BHCD, Bureau of Housing and Community Development, to track the number of people moving into the village and the outcomes when achieved of people moving out. The goal of Dignity Village is to provide transitional residence for people seeking to leave homelessness. So with that introduction, why don't you fill in?
Great. Well, thanks, and it was Commissioner Adams and Roland and his team have stepped in and really helped negotiate this agreement. I think everyone knows I've worked less closely this year because they've been taking the lead, and I think they've done a terrific job, which is why I wanted to have Sam share that. But this is something I have been working with for a long time, and I'm actually very proud of and think has turned into one of those unique Portland stories. I haven't actually read the whole thing, but there's a story in Willamette Week today about how other communities are now coming to Portland to study Dignity Village. So we get studied on many things. And to be just kind of short and to the point, perhaps, I think most people, myself included, thought Dignity Village was in the beginning truly a protest and then turned into an experiment and was one that perhaps did not seem likely to work but seemed well-intentioned. And what's happened over the years is that it's worked very well and turned into a great safe place for people who need it and a stepping stone for many people to get back to where they're trying to go. And it's been criticized a lot, and there's sort of this sense of, you shouldn't allow people to do this, that, or the other thing. And I think most of those criticisms tend to come from people who've not had a chance to go to Dignity Village and learn what it's all about, and also who I think purposely at times blind themselves to some of the alternatives. As much progress as we are making, and we're making great progress in this community on trying to end the institution of homelessness, we're nowhere close to having done that, and we're nowhere close to having enough housing. And so on any given night, people are going to be in very dangerous situations. And Dignity Village has taken that and given people a place to go. And I think the reason Dignity Village has succeeded, and I think there'll be people here who are far more qualified than I am to talk about why it succeeded, because you're actually there, is that I think it creates community. I think it's very simple. And I think that one of the things that we all need is a sense of acceptance and community and a place to be. And I think nobody in our society probably lacks that more than a person who's homeless and on their own. And Dignity Village has given people, and I'd be for the first to say, you sometimes get some of the individualists at Dignity Village and some of the folks who don't as easily adapt into some of the systems that we have out there. And I think that's perfectly great. And that's what Dignity Village has done, is given people a place to be. So I'm very proud of it. It's also, there's been a huge debate, too, about, is Dignity Village the answer to homelessness? And I don't think anybody in this room would say that Dignity Village is the answer to homelessness. I think it's a response for a relatively speaking small group of people. There are thousands of people with homelessness to what I still consider an unacceptable situation. I don't think what we're working towards is having Dignity Village for everyone, but I think while we work towards the broader goals, Dignity Village has been a terrific it's a solution that came from the people themselves as well, and that's what I think is really interesting about it. So we've threatened to have an agreement for 5 years now, and neither side has ever made good on that threat. So I believe Sam Adams has brought us to that point today where we actually do have an agreement. I think this is good. I would say in wrapping up, though, that the sense that we have not had a formalized signed agreement should not imply that we have not had working rules, relationships, and a whole series of, I think, testing and striving. And there has been a very clear relationship between the city and Dignity Village. There's been clear agreements with the police and other providers, and those have all worked very well. This is really a formalization in a lot of ways of, I think, something that has been working. And so I guess sometimes I know some couples don't want to get married because they feel that will lose the magic and by formalizing things. And so I suspect maybe we've waited for a while to get this down on paper, but I think it's a system that's been working very well. And by any stretch of the imagination, is the most cost-effective thing that people have put together in a long time. So my hat's off, and I think Roland's going to come up and give us a presentation. Is that right?
Yep. Good afternoon. I am Roland Chepowski. I am Commissioner Adams' director for policy director for transportation. It's amazing that I'm up here right now. We've been working towards this for a really, really long time, and it's good that it's finally coming to an end that I'm very, very pleased with. Before we really go into the substance, though, I also want to say that this has been a great effort from multiple bureaus and multiple offices. Eric's office has been really great with really a whole series of different folks who have been involved, whether it's Jamal or Bob or people before. And also, with this move and with the management agreement, which sort of go hand in hand, it's only because of the sort of collaboration of many different city bureaus that we've been able to really pull this off. And so I have to thank the Water Bureau, BHCD, BES, and PDOT for everything that they've done. I also want to just note that Andy Miller from BHCD is out sick today, but he has been a very, very great resource in this, as has the city attorney's office, Ben Walters. So just sort of going into this really quickly, Sam went through a lot of the history. I just want to talk about a couple of the highlights of the management agreement and sort of why I think that this is something that people of all political stripes would like. This is a sort of fully legalized relationship that will now sort of very, very clearly outline rules and the nature of the relationship that Dignity Village has with the city. Dignity Village is also going to now have their own sort of independently purchased insurance, which is good for them and good for us in that it clearly delineates the liability involved. We have one of the most important things, and something that Sam was very keen on having me make sure was a part of this, is the reporting requirements. And as Eric said, it's important that Dignity Village is truly transitional housing, and it's part of an overall strategy, and it doesn't become something that people sort of linger in for a while. And so this now will make there be sort of quarterly reporting requirements to BHCD. BHCD is going to be pulling together the form with all of the information, which will touch on a lot of things, but mostly it's going to sort of track who's been in there, how long, and sort of what is the rotation of people. Also, with this move and the management agreement, we're going to be dismantling some of the current buildings and rebuilding them. They'll be up to fire code. They'll be up to building codes. We're taking care of stormwater, safety access, and basically, this is a huge step forward for Dignity in basically going through all of the hoops of permitting that other entities have to go through as well. And really quickly, we're putting in or we're working with Dignity Village to also make them more self-sufficient in the payment of or in the using of utilities. So now they are going to have their own metered water and sewer. They're going to have their own electricity. And so the responsibility for that is also clearly delineated. And they, again, and this is mostly has been provided through in-kind services from different city bureaus. And so, again, I have to thank Water, BHCD, BES and PDOT for everything that they've done. So now Jill Jacobson, who has been the project manager for the Sunderland Yard Master Plan, is just going to touch on that a little bit, and then we can have some, if you have any questions, we can answer them. But then we have some folks from Dignity Village who would like to talk about this.
But before you begin, Jill, I just want to underscore my thanks to you. This is your background and your training, and is not necessarily in developing or helping to manage a temporary campground. And I just want to thank you for your willingness to stretch and to accommodate what I think is an important project with a very that fills a very important need. But thank you for all your work.
Thank you. As Roland said, I am the program manager for the Sunderland Recycling Facility. So I was here last year presenting the master plan for the expansion of the facility. And part of that master planning process, we were considering the relocation and the improvements to the campground. And that we started working well over a year ago with members of Dignity Village and their representation to make sure that the improvements met their needs and their expectations. And I think that worked really well. Roland would attend the meetings. We'd have representatives of BDS, any other agencies. The Fire Bureau was contacted, the Police Bureau, to make sure that the development and the improvements we put in made sense and met the expectations and city codes and was workable for Dignity Village. Dignity Village has an architect that worked with them for the actual design and layout of the facility. So we basically gave them a box and said, this is your area, and they designed that and set that up. We did coordinate with the other infrastructure bureaus in the installation of those improvements. And as Roland mentioned, it will be advantageous for everyone that they have a separate utility. We got a separate mailing address. They have their own address now. These type of things will add to their organization as giving it credence and credibility. Somebody mentioned other agencies interested in this. Thurston County came down last week. Thurston County is around Olympia, and they had 13 people, public public agency representation, who came down to look at what we're doing and how well it's working and why it's working. And I thought that was great that we were able to share that message with them. Somebody also mentioned the Willamette Week article. There is an article in the Portland Tribune, and it's posted on MSNBC.com today. So it's making international news, and I think that that is a good thing. Is there anything else I needed to cover?
No, that's it. But I the one thing I would say was with the delegation from Thurston County, they were really amazed at sort of what we were able to get out of really minimal sort of in public investment. And so when all is said and done, we estimate that there's going to be about $70,000 of these in-kind contributions. And if you assume 200 that Dignity Village assists 200 people a year going to permanent housing, which is a conservative and reasonable estimate, that's about $3,500 per person to go from being homeless to being in permanent housing, which is...
That would be a bargain, but I think you guys added a zero.
Oh, did I?
It was Andy. I caught his number.
Oh, okay.
It's 350.
350.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's actually even 10 better. Times cheaper.
Yeah, yeah. Great.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thanks, Roland. Thanks, Joe.
Is there a sign-up sheet?
Yes, there is, and we have 8 people signed up. Come up 3 at a time, please. Tim McCarthy, William Currier, Susan Parker, and they'll be followed by Aaron Smith, Jack O'Connor, and Gina Hatcher.
Good afternoon, folks.
Good afternoon.
Thanks for being here. When you speak, if you'd state your name for the record, and you each have 3 minutes.
You want to go first?
Oh, you go ahead.
Okay. Hello. My name is Tim McCarthy. I'm a resident of Dignity Village. And I would like to say thank you to all the commissioners and to the mayor for bringing this up at this time. It has been a long process. I have been one of the few with Dignity Village that has met with all of the groups that have that's doing the infrastructure and the moving of the village. And since we've gotten the fence down, we've already moved some of the structures to the new site. So we want to say thank you for that. I think that it's about time. 5 years is a long time, even though it was on a handshake. And it was a very good deal at the time. But putting it in paper and signing it means a lot, not only to us, but I think to the city. And we have other people coming from, we've had people here from Chico, California, and Boise, Idaho, and that was also looking at the motto of Dignity Village to start and set one up in their communities. And what's amazing to me, it's the service providers in the other cities that are coming to us to ask us. It's not the homeless people that are coming necessarily to ask us how we're doing. It is the people in on the boards and the commissions and commissioners of their cities. And if they have the time and everything to come down and look at what we're doing, then they've gotten themselves an idea because they talk to also with the city as well as us. And I just want to say thank you to everybody again, because we never say thank you enough, I don't think. We never pat people on the back for a good job well done. And I would like to also take this opportunity to say thank you to Jill. She has been a pleasure to work with. We holler at each other across the fence. That's what neighbors do. And so that's pretty good. The calls and the police calls and everything in the Sunderland neighborhood has dropped again this year. It was 40% lower than it was last year. I mean, I'm not going to say that Dignity Village is the main reason, but we don't have as much crime in our neighborhood of Sunderland as what was before, even including the Marine Drive area. So I would just like to say again, thank you.
Thanks, Tim. I guess it's my turn. Hi, my name is Susan Parker. I'm the chairperson of Dignity Village. I'm new here. I haven't been there as long as a lot of the other people. I wasn't really prepared. I had any idea what I was going to say, but you're just like I am, just a person up there. They're doing such a great job out there. We had a fire drill last night for the first time. We got 59 people out of the village at 2:00 in the morning in four minutes and 10 seconds. Right. You need to know we have to be able to get out of there. We have a fire. We have all kinds of things in place for the safety of the village and for the safety of the people around us. We have a good working relationship with the Portland Police Department, the Police Bureau, and the jail as well next door. The warden of the jail is so pleased with what we've done there since in the last 6 months that he's beyond words. He comes over and brings us coats and coffee in the morning. I don't really know what to say. I hope we can work well with you and get this contract signed. People here are in need with what's happening out there. They're working hard, building and working with the community. We have a relationship with Concordia University and with Portland State and with the Portland Youth Builders, and everyone's really supportive in the neighborhood of the people that are in the neighborhood. They're like us, that are all around us. We've tried to have that make that a good. I don't even know what to say.
Neighbor policy.
Good neighbor policy. I guess that's it. Jill's been great. Like I said, I'm just new. So I really don't know a lot of the history on just what's happened for me and what's happened for the people there that are with us. That's all I have to say.
My name is William Currier, and I'm a member of Dignity Village. I'm also an honorable discharge veteran of the United States Armed Forces. And I'd just like to say that if it wasn't for Dignity Village, me personally, I don't know where I'd be right now. Probably locked up in 5C of the mental ward at the VA, just going bonkers from living on the streets out here. I have to say, it's been an amazing experience for me. I just have a short statement from another veteran who wasn't able to be here that is an actual success story from Dignity Village. So if you give me a couple minutes, I'd just like to read the statement, and that's all I really have, other than to thank you to everybody involved. The statement is from a man named Israel. Sorry, my glasses are a little dusty. First, I would like to thank the City Council for allowing the time to listen to my statement. I want to apologize for my absence, but as I tell you my story about Dignity Village, you will understand. When I came to Portland, I came to try and start over, try again to quit drinking and using. When I arrived at Dignity Village, I quickly found work and started to get to know some of the head council at the village. They were great and had good structure of no tolerance or drugs and violence. At first, I started great. Then I began to use and drink and had an incident which included some violence. So I received 24 hours out, then appeared before the council to be reprimanded or punished. Then they gave me 30 days out, including going to treatment or some kind of presenting documentation so that I can prove that I've done some. So I thought to myself, these people have gotten to know me and care not to let me go and try not to help and try to help me. So I thought to myself, wow, what a way.